Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon, and yes, we've made it. It's U.S. Open week. We at Fox are obviously pumped up about it. I had a chance to go to Pebble Beach a few weeks ago. The golf course is in immaculate shape, and we were just hoping that the conditions would stay the same over the few weeks we waited to get here, and they have. And let me just tell you, this is going to be one of the most beautiful golf events you've ever watched on television. I'm not just saying that because I'm going to be a part of it. It's the golf course is in great shape. The weather looks like it's going to be pretty solid, and we are fired up. Brad Faxon, who I sit alongside all week long for Fox and the FS1 broadcast, joined me this week to just chat a little bit about the event, past U.S. Opens that he played in, Koepka, Tiger. He tells an unbelievable Jack Nicklaus and Fred Couples story. So stay till the end because you're really, really going to enjoy it. And before we get to Mr. Faxon, I just wanted to let you know about the all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X from Titleist. It's been redesigned for more speed, more precision, and more consistency than ever before. That's really good if you're a golfer. More speed, more precision, more consistency. All three of those things you will appreciate. If you compare the two models, the Pro V1 has a softer feel and lower flight than the Pro V1X. The Pro V1X, the ball that I play, has a higher flight with more spin and a firmer feel. Both models continue to provide proven drop and stop greenside control, lasting durability, and unsurpassed quality. And this year, for the first time, they are both available in yellow. I've played yellow Pro V1X in my local U.S. Open qualifier, in my sectional U.S. Open qualifier. I was one of the few in the field that were rocking the yellow Pro V1X. I played them with pride. I loved them. They had bacon stamped on the side. Make sure you check out the new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Prove how good you can be. Tee up the new Pro V1 or Pro V1X on your next round. You will not regret it. This podcast ran a little long, so I just want to get right to Brad. I appreciate him taking some time. I know he was headed out to the golf course when I bugged him. My flight was actually delayed into Monterey. I was in an Uber, headed to the airport. I refreshed my American Airlines app, and it just said flight canceled. And I was like, well, that's not ideal. So I texted Fax, and I was like, we were going to do this in person, but can we just jump on the phone and knock this thing out? And he was happy to join me and just chat about, you know, one of our favorite golf courses on the planet. And I would say one of the most spectacular hosts of the U.S. Open that we get a chance to be a part of. So here we go, Brad Faxon here on the Clubhouse. And we welcome back into the Clubhouse my cohort for the summer, Brad Faxon. And Brad now has a show on Sirius XM Radio on Mondays, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern, called Just the Fax. Check that out. A lot of fun. Has great guests. His guest list is one of the kind of the who's who of the golf world. Brad, you're at Pebble Beach. My flight's delayed in, so we're doing this. We're going to do this in person, but now we're doing it on the phone. So I first want to start with Pebble, just from 10,000 feet, your thoughts as you've walked around the golf course, you've taken a look at the greens, just your thoughts as we head into this championship of what the course looks like, conditions, all of those things.
Well, it's absolutely amazing. I'm actually, Shane, in my room right now, and if I walk in the front door or walk out the front door, I can see the first tee, unobstructed view except for a couple like trees, and then looking out the back now, I've got a beautiful view of Stillwater Cove, the sixth green perched up there on the cliff where our tower will be. It's just perfect, and the weather, it's a short sleeve. People are out here walking around in shorts. It's unreal.
Well, you know, like I was out there, I guess now 3-4 weeks ago, and we played, and, you know, I mean, Pebble can be a hit or miss. I mean, it just depends really on what the season gives you. If it's really rainy, you'll see it. You'll see kind of a really hardy rough. You'll see smooth greens. If you get a kind of dry spring into the summer, you can see it's super baked out. They've had a lot of rain this year, which I think the USGA has to be super pumped about, because I know you've been out there. Obviously, there was a viral video Patrick Cantlay made. There is some areas on this golf course that you simply cannot hit the ball into. And I would venture to say you've played in U.S. Opens at Pebble Beach before. This is as nasty a rough as you'll see. I mean, can you think of other U.S. Opens that you've seen rough this, I would say, this dense?
Well, I think dense is a good word. I think uniform is a good word. It's interesting. Last night, my wife, Dory, and I had dinner in the tap room with Joe Buck, our our host and Tommy Fleetwood joined us. And I asked Fleetwood, I said, you know, you played the course, and he's only played Pebble Beach once before. He played the AT&T this year, so he doesn't have a lot of experience around the course, never in a U.S. Open here. But he said the rough at Bethpage was thicker than it is here. And you referenced Cantlay, and if the listeners haven't seen Cantlay's video on his little demonstration, that was Emmy Award stuff. I thought he did a good job. But he said the rough around the greens is pretty thick, but it's not incredibly thick. But there are spots, like Cantlay shows, that if you get unlucky, you can hit a pretty good shot. If it kicks left instead of kicking right, you may find yourself in that Dustin Johnson territory or Tiger Woods territory when they both made triple bogeys on 2 and 3 respectively, where you're going to have a hard time getting a ball on the green from five yards off the green. It could be one of those where you'd hate to see that decide a hole or a championship, but it's tough. It's tough around the greens. There's the graduated rough that the USGA introduced years ago, where if you just miss the fairway, it's not as bad as if you miss the fairway by 10 yards. But it's always going to be a factor.
I want to get into somebody in form, somebody that you've worked with in the past, and I know you've become close to, I guess, in a work sense, if you will, is Rory McIlroy. I mean, what he did over the weekend in Canada, I mean, we haven't seen anybody do that in a long, long time. I said as good as it would have been, as fun as it would have been to see him shoot 59 yesterday, I'm almost more impressed that he shot 61 with two bogeys. I mean, bogeys 16 and 18, still shoots 61, runs away with that Canadian Open, and now the list of countries he's won at continues to grow. I was looking back at some numbers last night. I mean, the last player to win the week before winning a major championship was Rory McIlroy. He did it in 2014. He won the Bridgestone and then went into the PGA Championship and wins there. I was also looking at Rory's recent play in majors. And if you take out the Masters last year with Patrick Reed, when he was in the final group and he flags it on two and misses that eagle putt and then really wasn't in it after that, there's not a lot of major championships he's been in real contention on the weekend since really 2014. Do you feel like the play the week before can carry over into a golf course like Pebble Beach, this type of play that we haven't necessarily seen fit Rory's eye? Do you feel like this is something we will see him carry over, or do you feel like it's a completely new week for a guy like Rory?
No, I think this is a carryover week for him, and let me tell you why, because we go back exactly a year ago to Shinnecock Hills in the Open there, where he missed the cut. He took the week off before Shinnecock last year. He stayed up in Long Island with a friend, played a bunch of the different courses, and he got off to a poor start. And he intentionally has changed his schedule this year for this U.S. Open to play his way into form. I think he does a really, really good job at being able to come off an event and keep a playing mentality. And what's funny about this is he had a 3-week stretch, the Memorial, the Canadian Open, and then the U.S. Open, and he missed the cut at the Memorial, and on a course that he's had some success on, that he's played well, that you would think would fit his game. And by the way, it looks like any course can fit his game when he's on. But what was really impressive about the Canadian Open, other than his scores, It's a shorter course like Pebble, you know, around 7,000, 7,100 yards. It's got smaller greens like Pebble, and it's a course that he wasn't familiar with in a tournament that he hasn't played much in. Now, he hasn't played a ton of golf at Pebble Beach, but I think that this puts him in such a good mindset. He stamped the field, like you said, with approval here by dominating in every facet of his game, and his strokes gained putting numbers, which I'm, you know, really a big fan of lately, they were the best they've been since Bay Hill in 2018.
Yeah, and I mean, I do look at Pebble Beach, and we'll talk about this throughout the week. I know you and I've got a couple of pieces we're going to shoot for Titleist that focuses on this, but I mean, it's not a bomber's golf course. But when we say, what I find funny about that is when you look historically at champions of the U.S. Open. I mean, you look at Jack, who obviously beat the golf ball compared to players in his prime. Of course, Tiger, I would say, drove the ball as well as he ever drove in his entire career back in 2000. I was watching the 2000 U.S. Open final round, and I mean, with the equipment he was hitting then, he's hitting at 320 and 330 on some of these holes. And then you mentioned Dustin Johnson, who it looked like was going to cruise to victory back in 2010 until he kind of ran into some trouble at 2 and 3 and then kind of fell apart on a Sunday. Of course, one of the longest hitters out there. Phil's had a lot of success at the AT&T, hitting drivers all over the place, and he's talked about hitting drivers this week. Why is it? Are we saying it incorrectly when we say that this isn't a Bombers golf course, considering the success Bombers have had at Pebble Beach?
No, that's such a great question, and it's gonna we'll watch how it plays out. And if you look at Pebble Beach, there is going to be a wide variety of styles of play and players that can win here and do well. And I've gone through this over and over in my mind on. If you take the best drivers of the golf ball, and you certainly would put Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson, like you mentioned, in 2000 Tiger Woods in here, they really don't have to hit a lot of drivers. The second hole is one of those that everybody will hit driver. It's 515 yards. The course, as we said earlier, is softer than we've seen it, way softer than it was in 2010, where Dustin Johnson hit a driver, the ball rolled 75 yards, and he hit wedge into the par four from 515, but guys are going to have long irons in there. And honestly, I don't think, like a guy like Tiger, who's now more conservative off tee shots, he'll drive it on two. I don't think we'll see him hit another drive until maybe the ninth hole, because even the par 5-6, he'll be able to reach the green with two irons or a three wood and an iron. And then after 9 and maybe 10, you'll see a drive on 13. You'll see a drive on 14, even though if it's not reachable, guys may just play the tee shot on 14 for position, and then you may not hit another drive unless you want to be aggressive on 18. So I could see this being a guy winning, like Tiger at Royal Liverpool, where he only hit one driver at Hoylake when he won the British Open. It could be a very conservative off the tee, or you could have a guy like McIlroy was last week at Hamilton Golf Club, where he just says, screw it, I'm hitting driver everywhere.
Which seemed to be his mentality, and that leads me into, I mean, we are 9 minutes into this, and we do this every time, facts, and I feel bad for it, but this leads me into Brooks Koepka, and this is a guy that has seemed to throw all of the normal ideals out at every major championship he's won at, and said, I'm going to hit driver all over the place. I do not care what everybody else is doing. And you get to Pebble Beach, as you're saying, which is going to force driver out of these guys' hands because there's nowhere to hit it. And I want to ask, with Koepka, when he starts to game plan for this week, which I'm sure he's already done, is it going to be a Brooks Koepka game plan, or is it going to be a game plan that's similar to a lot of these other players, where he's going to be hitting a lot of driving irons and he's going to be hitting a lot of fairway woods and putting himself in the right position? Or is it going to be the Koepka that we've seen that's dominated these major championships with his driver off the tee?
If you look at where he's had the most success and look at his two U.S. Open wins, Shinnecock was not a Shinnecock that was a traditional U.S. Open site like we've seen it in the past. Fairways were much wider than they've been. And Aaron Hill is the widest, I think, that any fairways have ever been at a U.S. Open. And Koepka put on a driving exhibition like Tiger did here at Pebble Beach in 2000. But I think it's way more of a thinker's golf course. I think there's a lot of ways that a player can get frustrated here. And let me just list a few of them, Shane, because I feel like I've got a lot of experience at Pebble Beach. Some of it good, some of it bad, but I've played in three Opens here. It's nothing like it is in January, February. So these players that are coming in thinking they know the course, it's a totally different ballgame. And it begins with just the absolute look of it. It looks like a U.S. Open course right now. The dark green that you see around the fairways, it's a beautiful look and color. The bunkering, the grasses around the bunkering, the native grasses are up. They're brown. It looks like if you're a golf course kind of a snob or geek, you're going to love some of the looks you see here at Pebble Beach. But they are the smallest greens these players are going to ever see at a U.S. Open. They're the second smallest greens on tour next to Harbortown in Hilton Head. So your iron game has to be precise. But what has to be even better is when you miss a shot here, if you miss to the short side of any of these greens, you're going to have to put on an exhibition with wedge shots that'll be second to none, because it's so tough. All these greens have gotten so much smaller over the years, and they all slope away from every side. And that's, I don't know if that's Koepka's strength. And every time he hears a comment like me, like I just said, it seems to motivate him and get him more driven. But I don't know if this is going to be an ideal place for Koepka. And even though he's won two in a row, even though, you know, Curtis Strange's name is going to be brought up a lot because he was the last guy to do this in 88 and 89 and bring up Willie Anderson's name. I mean, it's going to be fun to watch him and how he goes about doing this.
Yeah, I mean, he made comments last week that I was not surprised by. I mean, he basically said he was using the Canadian Open as a warm-up. I mean, if you kind of like dive into the quotes he said. And I think you, if you're a PGA Tour director or if you work for the PGA Tour, you probably hate when you see those quotes. But I think we've always wondered why some of these top tier players, the Rorys and the DJs and the Tigers and the Phils and Ernie and Duvall and go on and on down the list, why they didn't mention this stuff more, because you knew that the majors meant so much more to these types of players. Koepka's just the first guy that says it. And again, it's like, I'm going to play myself into form and I'm going to get to the U.S. Open knowing that I am one of the favorites. And I think whatever's happened the last year with Brooks Koepka, with the way he talks to the media, the way he talks about golf, him saying that before the PGA Championship, you know, there's 35 guys that I have to beat and that's it. It might come off at times as arrogant, but if he believes it, that's all that matters. And I mean, you talk about Koepka coming into the U.S. Open. It's a thinker's golf course. I think a lot of the time we can look at him and go, you know, this is a big jock who lifts weights, yada, yada. You've heard all those themes a million times. But obviously, the guy has an unbelievable golfing brain. And what I am so interested in watching this week with Brooks Koepka is he will figure out a way to play this golf course. I truly believe that. And, you know, we can talk Tiger, we can talk Phil, who's had so much success here, Rory coming in so red hot. But Koepka has to be believed as a savant when it comes to professional golf because he figures out all these golf courses.
And he does it in the biggest stages. You know, he's had six career wins, four of them being those major championships, those two U.S. Opens back to back. So he does have the ability to do that. And I've always thought the players have the great knack to create their own reality in the way they think. And what I mean by that is Koepka says, and like you mentioned, to the detriment of the Canadian fans, that this is a warm-up for the U.S. Open. McIlroy went in there saying, hey, this is a national championship. I have another notch on the totem pole if I can capture something here. And he listed his Open Championship, his U.S. Open Championship, his Hong Kong Open Championship, his Irish Open Championship as coveted national titles. And Jack Nicklaus never won the Canadian Open. Rory knows enough about that history. I think a guy like Brooks Koepka doesn't care about history. He cares about himself. He took a page out of Nicklaus's playbook to kind of whittle down the field. And he did it in a nice way. You know, he said, look, I know that there's a bunch of qualifiers here, 78 guys that go to try and qualify, that they don't have a chance to beat me. And he can then say that I know that 30 of the guys other than that don't play enough or don't like the course, are going to be complaining about the conditions. They're out. And that's exactly how Nicklaus used to say it. And they were very good at saying this after they won, you know. But it's an intimidating factor. And Koepka will be a guy that when players see him plop down his couple range bags on the you know, his golf balls on the range, I don't know if people are going to want to snuggle up to him and hit balls next to him. You know, it's kind of like Tiger. It's like, who's brave enough
right
to hit balls when he's pounding that turf with those arms? You're like, I think I'll go down the other end.
So I want to talk about your U.S. Opens at Pebble Beach. I mean, you said it's nothing like the Pro-Am. It's a completely different beast. I know you qualified for one of them and got in. When you would play the U.S. Opens at Pebble going in, did you feel like it fit your game, or did you feel like it wasn't necessarily the type of golf that you felt like you would have success at?
Well, that's a great question. So my three Opens were 82, 92, and 2000, and I had no business being here in 82. I was a raw amateur out of Rhode Island. It was, I was 19 or 20 years old when I got here. I had never played Pebble Beach, never played in a U.S. Open, only had played in one PGA Tour event. So my eyes were, you know, wide open. I had a great time and didn't even come close to making the cut. I shot 77 and 74, something like that. But then in 92, And in 2000, I was, you know, in the middle of my best part of my career. And again, I don't think I had, and never showed in any of my career U.S. Opens that I had the ability to play a golf course where hitting it in the fairway was really important and being able to stop a green. I was kind of a low ball flight, low spin guy with great short game. And your short game on a course like this gets kind of negated when the rough is so high around the greens that it becomes harder for everybody to get the ball close. And I played in 2000, parred the first four holes, and I got up to the newly designed Jack Nicklaus par 3 fifth on the cliffs. It's one of the most gorgeous settings in the world. And I hit a 6-iron into that flag about 5 feet right of the green and went down and found the ball on a tuft of, you know, the seaside grasses down there. And I made a decision to try and play this shot, and I came away with a quadruple bogey 7, and I was basically done. And I was really playing good golf then. I thought I had a chance to do well, but I mean, the penalty for a miss here can be so dramatic in just a small time. And we referenced DJ on 2 in 2010, making a triple bogey, and Tiger on number 3 in 2000, which makes it even more amazing that he could win by 15 and make a triple bogey.
Want to take just a moment to let you know that golf's third major of the year is coming up, and even though the trophy is reserved for the winner, the big cash prizes don't have to be. With $1 million up for grabs, $1 million bucks, there's no better time to try 1 week fantasy golf at DraftKings. It's easy to play. You pick just 6 golfers under the $50,000 salary cap before the tournament tees off. Then you sit back and follow the action. Simple as that. The more red numbers they have on the leaderboard, the closer you'll be to winning some serious green. You can rack up points for pars, for birdies, for finishing position, and more. And DraftKings will also be running a huge, that's all caps, huge fantasy golf millionaire contest where the top prize is $250,000. So download the DraftKings app or go to DraftKings.com before tee off on Thursday. Select your golfers and use the code Clubhouse at sign up to play for $1 million bucks in prizes. That's code Clubhouse, and enter the fantasy golf contest for $1 million in prizes only at DraftKings. $10 entry. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details as we get back to Mr. Brad Faxon.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you're kind of rewatching some of these old U.S. Opens, I think that's forgotten. I mean, I do believe people remember the Tiger hit it in the ocean in 2000 and made, I think he made 6 on 18 on his second ball. But I feel like people forget he made a triple and still won by 15, which is unreal. And when you watch the way he played on Sunday, I feel like if you haven't seen this yet, you can go, USGA now has an app, and you can go watch all the final rounds from every U.S. Open, and it's great. You can watch it on your Apple TV. But I watch 2000, and when you watch Tiger the first 9 holes, and he just makes a whole bunch of pars in a row, and he knows that's all he needs. He could shoot 78 and still win the U.S. Open. But the way he did it, he was a tactician unlike anything we'd ever seen. And I just, the contentness of the par putts and the par saves, he talked about it in his presser. He said, you know, making a 10-footer for par at a U.S. Open is almost more satisfying than when I make a birdie putt. And it was really beautiful to watch. I mean, making a whole bunch of pars in a row a lot of the times isn't the sexiest thing for golf fans to see. But when a guy is in that control of his game, it felt a little like the way he was hitting his irons at the Masters on Sunday, where every shot, they weren't necessarily darts throughout 18 holes on Sunday. They were all in the exact spot they needed to be. And I'll be very interested to see, coming off the way he played at the Memorial in Tiger Woods, is he going to have control of his irons? Because if he does have similar control than what we saw at Augusta National, he's very much going to be in the mix over the weekend. I mean, I can only assume you agree with that, considering what we've seen this season.
There's no doubt about it, Shane. And McIlroy made a great point after he played with Tiger Woods in the final round of the Tour Championship at Eastlake, which is one of those courses that's as tough as the fairways the players play and tough of greens to hit as the players play all year long. And he said, McIlroy said afterwards, because there's no player I've ever played with that hits his irons more a pin high more often than Tiger Woods. He is the best iron player on the PGA Tour. And when we talked about this, Shane, you and I, about how he took apart the back nine on Sunday at Augusta National with high shots, low shots, draws and fades, every shot going to the correct side of the flagstick where he needed to make a par or a birdie. And think about this. When he played his last round in 2000, his goal was to go out there and play and make just par in every hole. Now, if he said if he made a bogey, if he had a bogey free round, nobody could catch him. Obviously, easier said than done. But he went out 15 greens, and it was even to the point where if the pin was on the left, he was on the right side of the fairway. If the pin was on the right, he was on the left side. You know, it was an amazing how he took this tactician sort of approach to Pebble Beach, and he hit more greens than any player that day when he had that gigantic of a lead. And I thought that the one stat that was incredible was that there were four bogey-free rounds the entire week, and he had two of them. So Tiger Woods, and what I think this is a great thing to think about. So what he was able to do, you know, we've always, you know, talked about these axioms or idioms that you got to play one shot at a time, you got to stay patient, you can't get ahead of yourself, you got to stay in the present. Tiger did that by making his goal, I got to play one shot at a time, I'm going to make par in every hole, and to make par in every hole, I got to hit the fairway.
Right.
And to make a par, I got to hit it on the green. And he was able to slow down the game, and all the great athletes in whatever sport it was, they were able to take that picture and slow it down. And that was the reality for Tiger Woods that I think was so impressive and really not talked enough about, was how he was able to continually to keep hitting one good shot in a row.
Yeah, it felt, I mean, this is obviously topical, but when you watch Rafa Nadal play on clay, and you always feel like the opponent is on the back of their heels, and it always looks like no matter what position Nadal is on the court, that he's A, going to get to the ball, and B, going to keep it alive. And that's all he's trying to do. Let's keep it alive until either my opponent makes a mistake or they hit a mediocre shot. And the moment a mediocre shot comes over the net, he is going to jump on it, take advantage, and hit a winner. And he does it against Federer, and he does it against time. I mean, he does it against the best in the world. And I feel like that stretch we saw Tiger play, Pebble and then into the Old Course, you're talking about a guy that, you talk about Koepka having confidence. I mean, he went into it truly believing that there wasn't a golf shot he was going to miss for 72 holes. And that is, I'm not sure we've seen anything like that since the current Brooks Koepka we see at these major championships. I do want to ask you something, Fax. We did this on your radio show, and I want you to do it here. I want you to defend the first hole at Pebble Beach.
I've had this conversation two times already today, this morning. It's 9:30. I've already talked about it because a buddy of mine from home said number one's the weakest hole on the course. And then I had coffee this morning with Commissioner Jay Monahan talking about number one being one of my favorite holes on the course. And I got this quizzical look, and I'm going, look, it's a benign tee shot. Look, but you still have a fairway that narrows up there where the golfer needs to hit his shot to have a reasonable approach into this green. It's a 400-yard dogleg to the right with a sloped fairway, pretty severely sloped fairway left to right, that if you the higher up the hill you hit it to the left, the more it slopes below your feet. And now you kind of have a shot that you want to draw into this from this lie that makes you want to hit a fade or a cut shot if you're a righty. So pressing that tee shot off the tee is important to get it down there farther to have a shorter shot. Now, when you look at this second shot from 130 or 40 yards away, sometimes 150 yards away, it's uphill more than you think. The fairway, the green slopes at you way more than you think. And the right side of this green, it really falls off. That right bunker is almost impossible. It's so deep that in the sand down there is flat, so you don't get the benefit of an uphill lie. It's hard to get it up and down there, and it's a hole that every player on this field is going to walk away if they make a four, and they're going to be happy. It's a hole that I think the general public doesn't appreciate it because you don't have any view of the water. And every other hole, it looks like if you at least stand on your tiptoes, you can see the water from somewhere, but you can't do it on one. And I think that's a tragedy, really, because I think it's a beautiful design.
Okay, you told a story, if you're willing to do it again. You told me a story the other day about you playing Pebble with Jack Nicklaus and Fred Couples, and Couples doing, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe just maybe something out of the ordinary to have a little bit of fun with Jack. And I'm not sure what year it was, but if you don't mind rehashing that story, I can only imagine people would really, really eat it up.
This is one of my favorite stories that ever happened to me in my career. And I got paired with Jack Nicklaus and Fred Couples and a forgotten fourth guy named Charlie Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S, on the final round in 1986, which is the year Jack would eventually go on to win the Masters. But I was so excited to make this cut because I had played an amazing third round at Cypress Point in tremendous wins to get into the Sunday round, because it was a 54 cut.
And this was the AT&T Pro-Am, the Clam Bake, whatever you want to call it at the time. Yeah,
it might have been the Crosby then, or the first year of the AT&T. And Jack Nicklaus had shot a couple first rounds of 69, and then shot 80 the third round. His son Steve was his amateur partner, and he was miserable. So he made the cut on the number. So we're starting late on the 10th hole. Nobody wants to get on that shuttle to go out and play 10 at Pebble with the trouble of the right and the cold and the time it takes, the extra time it takes. So Nicklaus, Freddie and I are playing, and Charlie and Freddie and I were friends, and Freddie was kind of a phenom there. He is vaulted to the fame. He's one of those guys every guy wanted to hang around with him. Every woman wanted to, do more than that. And he just had this aura about him. So we're playing, and Jack, like he always did, was competing like this was a final round of a major championship. And on the 18th hole, Freddie had hit a nice drive. And back then, remember, a lot of balls, wooden drivers. He had a deep-faced M85 tourney McGregor driver. And he takes it off the deck and goes to hit this cut shot up onto the 18th hole. Now, Jack hasn't really said a lot to me. We've had some pleasantries, but as Freddie's standing over his ball, Jack comes up to me, and I apologize if my voice doesn't sound. Jack kind of has this squeaky little voice sometimes, but he goes, I don't think this is a very smart shot. And Freddie hits his beautiful drive off the deck, cuts it out over the water onto the green, and two putts for a birdie. So, I ran up to Fred and said, Jack didn't think you hit a good shot. He goes, why? He goes, I said, I don't know. He just didn't think that was smart or something. He goes, well, watch this. So Freddie continued to do stuff that still amazed me that day. He took driver out on the first hole because we started on 10, which was our 10th hole of the day, and hit a driver where no player in the field probably hit a driver. And he hit it up there, past the second tee box, chipped it on the green, made a birdie. And Jack, Jack was kept running up to me like I had something to do with this. And he kept whispering, he doesn't have any discipline. And he knocks it on the second green and two, makes birdie there, hooks it around three. Now on three, Jack can't believe Freddie's taken driver out because, he's a cutter of the golf ball. And Fred hits that unbelievable draw around the corner there and wedges that one on the green for another birdie. So now he's birdied 18 with a four. He's birdied one, two, and three, and he takes driver out on four, which Jack would never consider. This was so out of character, and now he's almost grabbing me. And of course, I'm reporting every move Jack makes to Fred back then. I'm 25 years old, and Freddie's like, this is great. So, Freddie, he gets to five or six under for the round after birdie in number six. And then on number eight, a hole that, the fairway ran out at 250 or 60 yards. Every player would be hitting a two iron or a three wood downwind. Freddie took out driver there, knowing that there was no place this ball could go except for down on the cliff. But he aimed it 50 yards left on purpose down in the hot dog stands just to get a rise out of Jack. He made a certain bogey, but Jack couldn't believe that he was doing this. And I couldn't believe I was hearing this from him and watching Jack, Freddie do this. It was one of the greatest days of my life.
I mean, you said he made like five or six birdies in a row, and he's just beating driver all over the place just to mess with him. It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's just, is there anybody else that you would have known in professional golf at the time that would have done this? I mean, everybody else would have been going, if Jack doesn't think this is a smart move, there's no way I'm going to hit this club. And Freddie was going, I'm just going to have a little bit of fun with him.
Oh, he had more and more fun every time Jack made a comment to me, and I Freddie would be running over to me. What did he say? What did he say? it was classic Fred. And talented Fred.
Oh yeah, well that's and that was the point you made to me when you're telling me. You're like, I mean, he's hitting these unbelievable golf shots on with the clubs you should never pull in a million years. I mean, driver on three, driver on one, as you mentioned, driver on eight, and you're going, no, don't hit it. And he's like, I don't care. I'm just going to swing it, and we'll see. It's almost daily-esque, We're like, let's just try it, and we'll see what number we make. Going back to this U.S. Open, as we kind of wind down, we've mentioned, you know, some of the favorites. Obviously, we talked a little bit about Rory and Koepka and Tiger. We haven't really touched on Phil, but I mean, there's five, six, seven, eight names I think everybody has in their pool, if you will. Is there names, considering, you know, you already have mentioned that this is going to be a pretty open U.S. Open in the sense of, you know, it's not a distance place. You don't have to bomb it 350 to get around this golf course. Is there some names outside of the norm that you're looking at that you feel like has a really, really good chance this week to make a move and to potentially win this thing?
There's no doubt about it. And I would, this is no secret, but I would put Patrick Cantlay's name right up at the top too. He won a Memorial, you know, he didn't do it as convincingly as Rory did in Hamilton, but he did win by two. He did shoot 19 under par. You know, he was two ahead of second. He was four ahead of third. He was six ahead of fourth. So he kind of lapped the field there, and he's, if you look at statistics and strokes gained, approach shots, he's the best player on the tour from 150 to 200 yards. And that's going to be a key statistic to look forward to at Pebble. So I would put Cantlay there. Obviously, that's not a stretch. But some of the other names that definitely will be in contention and have a chance, like I said, I had dinner with Tommy Fleetwood last night. I think he's got the kind of game. We saw what he did last year at Shinnecock on the final day with a 63. And Francesco Molinari, who can take apart a golf course as well. And you and I know that there's a lot of Europeans that the Americans don't know as well as we do. But Matt Wallace, who's won, I believe, four times in Europe in the last year, he started to play a little bit more over here. We've seen his name on the leaderboards. I don't think it would be a far stretch to see Wallace up there. And here's my, you know, my big stretch. I might get laughed at this, but the ageless wonder, Ryder Cup captain Jim Furyk.
Nice.
I think this course could actually be a place. You know, he's got the experience here. He's got the experience in U.S. Opens, having won, you know, at Olympia Field. He played well last week in Canada. I think these courses were similar. You know, heavy, rough fairways that mattered. You know, if you hit in them or not. And I think Furyk is, you know, after taking, you know, you basically take 2 years off from playing golf when you're a Ryder Cup captain. But he's shown a little form. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to see him give a little charge.
I'm looking at the way he's played at this in particular U.S. Open course. Not great in 2000, but tied for 16th in 2010, obviously when Graham McDowell won. So, you know, I mean, he's one of those guys that just has always seemed to find his best play at major championships when it is a U.S. Open. He's like the U.S. Open grinder, the guy that just can get around a golf course. And, I think it's a great call. I mean, he's like you said, you don't have to bomb it. He can hit driver on holes where these guys are going to hit two iron, and he'll be right where they are. And that's really all you need. Did you think Rory was going to break 60 yesterday?
Well, it's funny. I had gotten off the airplane in San Francisco, and my wife and I are driving down. We had PGA Tour radio on, listened to the call. And by the way, I never thought listening to golf on radio, obviously it's not ideal, but they do a really, really good job of explaining what's going on. You can hear the crowds, hear the sounds.
It's really underrated. I think it's kind of almost more fun sometimes because it changes up the way your brain works.
Yeah, you know, you used to listen to baseball on transistor radio when I was a kid. And
you're aging yourself.
You didn't
yourself,
want anybody to talk. You just wanted to listen to. I'm aging myself, no question. But I definitely had some fun. Listening on radio, I had people texting me the whole time, which is not a ride you want text to coming down whatever Highway 17 that is coming down to, into the forest. But it was cool to listen to. And when McIlroy made his eagle on 17 and got to 10 under par, the 18th hole is the hardest hole in the golf course, really. It's almost unfair for the long hitter because there's nowhere to hit it. But it was – like, could he shoot 59 and win that? You know, David Duval did it back at the Bob Hope, I don't know how many years ago. It's amazing that he could go out with the lead, not having won with the lead in what we said 4 years. And he put on a performance I don't think he knew he had inside of him. But he stayed patient. He stayed free.
It was crazy. And again, I mean, you've harped on this a lot. I mean, he is a guy that – if the putts are going in, it's just he is going to be in contention. It doesn't matter the golf course or the circumstance or anything. I mean, the guy is the best, I would say, the best driver of the golf ball maybe we've ever seen. And obviously when the irons are on and the wedges are on, that was something I was really impressed with, was his wedge control every wedge he hit, not only was it close, but you could see it in his face. He knew it was going to be close. I mean, they weren't yanking back. You know, they were kind of those dead hand looking wedges that were just hitting and stomping right around the hole. And for us, we can only hope he brings that to Pebble, because, you know, if he's in control of those clubs at this golf course, he's going to have a really good chance. Have you gone and saw our booth yet? Because I'm really jealous if you have.
I have not been inside it. I walked by it yesterday with Dory. It's spectacular.
Golly, it's going to be so
right
awesome.
Right to the right of the fourth fairway. When I told Jay Monahan where we were, he goes, "Oh my God, I can't believe I could fit it in there." So I'm so excited about it, Shane, and I'm excited for us at Fox, for the USGA, because it almost looks like nothing can go wrong here. The only thing that I hope doesn't happen, I mean, we certainly don't mind adverse conditions, but I don't want to see a crazy final round like 92 when Kite won and had to kind of endure these 30-mile-an-hour gusts of wind. I want the course to be playable. I don't mind if the scores are double digits. If 10 under wins this U.S. Open, I don't think anybody's going to care. I think they just want to see some good competition, good, great golf.
Where does Pebble rank for you, not just as a player back when you were playing in these championships, but as now a broadcaster and a fan of golf and love watching golf at an elite level? Where does Pebble rank in terms of your favorite U.S. Open golf courses?
I think it's my favorite, and for a lot of reasons. Number one, as a kid watching and really starting to pay attention to golf in the early 70s when Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer were the two guys you turned the TV on for. That's the first time I saw Pebble Beach, and I'll never forget the last day Jack played and the great shot he hit at 17, and then the 18th hole, and learning about the history, then getting to play here as an amateur in 82, hearing Nicklaus's comments that it's just, you know, if you had to play one last round of golf, it'd be Pebble Beach. And then having played here for, I don't think I ever skipped this event in my career. I'm fortunate enough that my amateur partner, the past CEO of CVS Pharmacy, Tom Ryan and I won the Pro-Am competition. Our names on etched on the wall, the rock behind the first tee, which I took a nice picture of yesterday. So I'm here for eternity, whether people like it or not. And as a golf fan, I think it's the greatest venue. I think it's the greatest course. And as a golf critic and an architect, fan, I think this course could even be better than it is. I think that the greens have kind of gotten too small. The encroaching of the bunkers and the grass getting mown in too much. I just think they could make it even better and better. And they've done a nice job kind of redoing some greens on 13, 14. We know 17 was redone, but I think the Pebble Beach company knows what they can do to make this even better, which is even more exciting.
Facts, have you looked at our schedule? You and I on Thursday, I'm pretty sure they're going to have Red Bull like IV'd into our veins. I think we have an hour and a half break on Thursday. We're on all morning and all evening, and you and I have both mentioned to our boss, we're down. If you want us in that booth, we will be there and doing it as long as you need us to be. I mean, we get excited, we get amped up for any event we get to do together, but this one, for whatever reason, I think Shinnecock was very similar. This one feels different. The storylines going into it, some of the guys playing well, some of the history in terms of players that have won here before. Of course, you know, with Tiger Woods now notching already another major championship on his belt here in 2019. I cannot wait for Wednesday for our preview show and then Thursday to get this thing going because, you know, to piggyback on last year, I mean, it was so much fun for us to get to be a part of this and to get to team up with Paul and Joe. And it's one of the best weeks of the year for golfers. And it's definitely you and I's, I would say, favorite week to get a chance to call this championship.
Well, it is, Shane. And first of all, I agree. I would put a cot in the tower so we could sleep there and just get IV because I'm so excited. I don't know how much I'll need to sleep this week. But our team at Fox is as good as we can have right now. I mean, you mentioned having and Joe and Paul, and then we tag team with those guys. And then we're on together with those guys. And then I'm, you know, to have Curtis Strange, two-time Open champion, walking with the final group. So we've got a fearless group, Steve Flesch, Brett Quigley, a whole digital team that work together and are proud of it. But here's what I've been thinking about. You know, this is our fifth Open now since we started at Chambers Bay. we've kind of had to try and come up or make up some sort of reason why this was going to be a great U.S. Open. The reasons this year are obvious. I don't think we have to work or fight to make a viewer turn the TV on here. And you and I were so excited last year at Shinnecock because we're getting Tiger Woods out right out of the box on the first hole. And, you know, you talk about some of these Titleist performance pieces that we do, the in-game promos. And we did a chip shot from behind the first green and said, you know, you just can't hit it over number one at Shinnecock. You can't finish. And Tiger's first shot from the middle of the fairway on number one, he hits it over the green.
Over the back. Ugh.
Then he hit it over, and then he left it over, and he makes triple. And it was like all the wings were out of the sails then. And then, you know, the debacle on Saturday and Phil's escapades. So there's a million reasons why you want to watch this Open. And it really only has to say Pebble Beach is all you have to say.
Right.
But then you can go, well, Tiger Woods, Masters champion. Brooks Koepka, three in a row. Rory McIlroy, U.S. Open, you know, can he win another one after winning last week? You can put some unheralded guys that haven't won. Phil Mickelson, can he win a U.S. Open finally at a course that's his favorite? It's endless storylines. And the course, Shane, I walked on the practice putting green last night, and I go, I cannot see a flaw right here. I hit a few putts. There were a couple that the townspeople came out to putt last night. I mean, it was beautiful.
Facts, I got to tell you, that was like just four name drops in one podcast. I'm actually really impressed. It was, now, mind you, it was the commissioner of the PGA Tour. It was Joe Buck. It was Tommy Fleetwood. But I was expecting a couple more. I'm very impressed.
You wanted me to have more, or you think this is just not enough?
No, I'm just telling you, I normally set the over-under on name drops at like 8.5, 9, you know, depending, maybe 15, if there's a lot. And,
well, listen,
and you were, I was very proud of you there.
I got more. I saw Curtis Strange was at the
bar
last night.
Oh, goodness, here we go.
Buck ate with us. J.B. Holmes came in and said hello. I told you. Fleetwood was there. Mark Loomis, our producer, was very upset last night. I never see Loomis get upset, but he was hoping to have a certain type of a camera positioned behind the gallery stands on 18 so that it could, I don't know what they call that, but it can float around. You probably know the name of the camera better than I do. You would see it in football games and stuff like that, but the Pebble Beach company didn't know we were trying to do this, and they kind of gave him the no for the next couple days. So that was a disconsolate Mark Loomis that I've never seen before.
Well, I'm sure. I'm going to tell you this. It's probably a bummed out Joe Buck, too. The Blues just got steamrolled. That game was over. I bet you were really enjoying it. Now, what day is it? What day is game seven?
Game seven's Wednesday night, so that's good for us.
Get
we're on
out
the air
of the way,
early
yep.
Wednesday for the preview show. We'll get this out of the way. And I was probably wearing my Bruins logo, black and gold hat last night, and Buck had his Blues hat on. And he was upset, and the Stanley Cup, I mean, it's my favorite sport to watch live, that no home team has won in the last three games. So it's interesting going back to Boston now for game seven. Can they break that little hex?
Yeah, we'll see. Just a reminder, as I've said, and as Brad just mentioned, we have a preview show Wednesday for a couple hours, and then we hit the ground running Thursday. I mean, I think we're on 9:30 Pacific time, so 12:30 Eastern, and that's Thursday and Friday. And we will be on basically the entire day as we roll into the primetime hours on Fox. So set your DVRs, get in front of a TV. We'll roll into Father's Day. It's gonna be an awesome U.S. Open. And I've tried to explain to kind of my sister, my wife, some of my friends that maybe aren't big golf fans, and you said it perfectly, I thought, is really all you have to say about this U.S. Open is Pebble Beach. And then you can just kind of expand from there on all the storylines. But just getting to see this golf course with the technology we will have at Fox in 2019 and the condition the golf course is in, I mean, you know, you could have aliens land on the planet, turn the TV on, and go, wow, that looks really good. So I'm really pumped to be a part of it. And our set's going to be great, and I cannot wait to get there. I'm not going to yell at American Airlines on social media. I refuse to do that. But I am bummed that I'm 4.5 hours delayed to get there. But I appreciate you jumping on, Facts. And yeah, like I said, we'll knock out some stuff tomorrow shooting. We'll have a show on Wednesday, and then the U.S. Open gets going, and we'll see come Sunday. Is it going to be a three-time, three back-to-back-to-back, or is it going to be somebody different, and can Tiger get 16? Should be a lot of fun.
Shane, listen, I appreciate it. I could go on with you every day and talk about this. And let me just throw one more thing out there, because I think it's worth telling your listeners that you became a dad. You and Cindy gave birth to Henry Bacon last week. A perfect timing to have the baby between our U.S. Women's Open and the U.S. Open this week. Congrats on that. Fantastic. And hey, Father's Day on Sunday at the U.S. Open, it's become a pretty cool tradition.
Yeah, it's going to feel a little different this year, that's for sure. I will say, Fax, I got a Pebble Beach onesie when I was out there a few weeks ago, and it's 0 to 3 months. I put Henry in it yesterday, and let me tell you, not quite the fit. It's not like a European fit on him. It's a little baggier. It looked like what you guys would wear in 95. It was like the big sleeves and the big baggy pleated pants. So he's going to have to grow a little bit more into the onesie I got him. But I did snap a couple of pictures, so I'll have that for my memory bank. But he's going to, like I said, it's going to be a month or two before he really, really can wear that with pride.
Awesome, Shane. Well, I look forward to seeing you. Get up here quick. Come on.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
A big thanks to Brad for joining me. Just wanted to let you know some times before I let you go and before I hopefully get out to Pebble Beach. Wednesday, 12:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern on FS1 is our preview show. That is where we preview the event, talk to players on the course, look at some of the hole locations for the week. Thursday and Friday, 12:30 p.m. to 7:30 Eastern, we go. That's on FS1. Then from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. Eastern, we are on Big Fox. Saturday, noon to 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox. Sunday, 2 to 10 p.m. on Fox. All of those times are live coverage of this U.S. Open, so prepare yourself. There will be a lot of golf shown, a lot of live golf, and we are fired up about it. Big thanks to Titleist and to DraftKings. We will check in with you following this U.S. Open next week. Have a great one.